Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, what is it? Where did it come from?
It was an American security guarantee over Western Europe, a few Western European countries, as well as Canada. It's more than that. If you dig a little deeper, it was actually a form of U.S. control over these countries after the war.
How did NATO become a global force imposing its will on countries outside of the North Atlantic?
Both the Gulf War and the breakup of Yugoslavia are key to the globalization of NATO. Most people think of Yugoslavia as NATO's first operation, out-of-area operation, but in reality, the first out-of-area operation was the Gulf War in 1991.
So I'm delighted to have as a guest this week on Talk Nation Radio, Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. He is an interdisciplinary sociologist, an award-winning author, and a noted geopolitical analyst. He is a researcher at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, Canada. The website is globalresearch.ca. He is an expert contributor at the Strategic Culture Foundation in Moscow, Russia, and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica, a peer-reviewed journal of geopolitics in Italy. Mahdi, I'm delighted to welcome you to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. You are a guest because of your terrific new book, The Globalization of NATO, which I recommend to everyone listening. But tell us briefly, where are you from? What's your background? How did you become an expert on something like NATO?
Well, first of all, I have a background with NATO as a former member of the Canadian Armed Forces. I've studied the organization for years now. It's almost 8 years that I've been studying the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and its role outside of the Euro-Atlantic zone, specifically starting with Afghanistan, not Yugoslavia. I started off with studying their role in Afghanistan. And from there on, I noticed the trend for out-of-area operations and a globalizing effect taking place in the organization. And like a lot of my work has been documenting this. Even the North Atlantic Treaty Organization itself has acknowledged me as an expert on the subject. They've archived my work in Brussels on the war on Libya in their media library. And my work's been translated on NATO all around the world. Al Jazeera is one of the first organizations to translate into Arabic. It's been translated into Spanish. Numerous languages used in defense colleges from Canada to specific European countries and the United States itself. So that's my background with the organization in a nutshell.
It doesn't strike me after reading this terrific book, The Globalization of NATO, that you intended it to assist in the work of defense, so-called defense colleges. Did you?
No. The thing is, I don't. I do talk about NATO from a critical perspective. If that's the best way to term it. But the thing is, I'm not there for, I don't have a political agenda. I have a certain viewpoint, of course, but I don't have a political agenda. And I try to make my work as neutral as possible. And I think this is acceptable. Like, it's analysis of the facts. The facts are the facts. When a certain place gets bombed, that place gets bombed. You can't question it. It's the politicization of those facts that causes it to causes bias distinctions about it. But I think that NATO and many other military bodies around the world need unbiased facts, and that's why even if you're critical of them, they'll have to take that into account when they're coming up with new tactics, strategy, you name it. So they need unbiased analysis.
Well, you've done a great job of it, and I confess to having a political point of view and to having come away from your book with the understanding that NATO had evolved from something theoretically defensive and North Atlantic to something rather aggressive and global. I wonder if you could just tell people where NATO originated. What did it begin as? And
most people, if they don't know, should know that it started off as a mutual defense pact in name, nominally.
Right.
In reality, it was an American security guarantee over Western Europe, a few Western European countries, as well as Canada. It's more than that. If you dig a little deeper, it was actually a form of U.S. control over these countries after the war. In fact, you can call it the post-World War II occupation of Western Europe. NATO forces were there to guarantee that governments that would not be in the political favor of Washington would not exist or come to exist in these countries. You have to understand that at the end of World War II, there was a very strong chance in many of these Western European countries that the socialists and the communists would take over. In fact, they were all mostly part of the coalition governments. If most people don't know, the resistance movements in Western Europe from France, let's say, to Norway, all had communists involved. In fact, the communists did a lot of the hard fighting. Now, in Eastern Europe, it was the opposite. They had coalition governments that also involved non-communists and non-socialists. And when polarization began to take hold during the Cold War and after World War II, the Soviets had the non-communists, socialists, pushed out of government in their sphere, and the Americans did the same. And they used NATO as an insurance guarantee that communists or socialists would not come into power in Western Europe. So in most people should think of NATO as post-World War II occupation of Western Europe. It might sound radical to them, but in reality, this is what it was. In fact, if you look at the stay-behind organizations that NATO organized in these countries, the most popular or famous one is the Gladio in Italy. They're NATO's secret brigades, which were working to prevent communists or socialists or progressive parties that would be opposed to U.S. foreign policy or would make their countries neutral or Soviet allies. Secret brigades were there to keep these political parties out of power.
Work that included assassinations and framing the other side for those crimes and so forth, correct?
Yes, this is well documented. This is a matter of public record now that the NATO was involved in this, specifically the United States with Britain as its junior partner. This is not just NATO countries. It involved non-NATO countries. Switzerland had their stay-behinds. Other countries like Sweden had stay-behinds. So the stay-behinds were in what you can call the Western Bloc and the neutral non-NATO members of the Western Bloc.
So it's useful, I think, to think in terms of World War II never completely ending. We didn't scale back the military spending. We didn't do away with the military presence. We began to expand it, and yet from reading your book, I take it that NATO changed dramatically after the Cold War, and in particular with its actions in the 1990s in Yugoslavia.
Yes, it did change. The characteristic changed. There was a power vacuum. The collapse of the USSR, the Soviet Union, left a power vacuum in Eastern Europe. It left a power vacuum in the world order, the order of things on the international arena. The United States was given free rein now to become a hyperpower. As the sole superpower in the world, it could basically do whatever it wanted, and the events in Iraq and Yugoslavia are very important. Both the Gulf War and the breakup of Yugoslavia are key to the globalization of NATO. Most people think of Yugoslavia as NATO's first out-of-area operation, but in reality, the first out-of-area operation was the Gulf War in 1991. It was a NATO operation. It was NATO planning and strategy that was used against Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis. It was all NATO equipment. And it was in the framework of the alliance that the war took place. And NATO experts experts all acknowledge this. It was the strategy that they used in Iraq that would open up the door for the same type of behavior and militarism in Yugoslavia, but to a far greater degree. And this is when the organization's mandate started changing officially from a defensive one to one where offensive action in the name of humanitarian intervention began to take hold.
So the so-called first Gulf War took NATO out of the North Atlantic, but then it seems that Yugoslavia, in terms of legalistic justification, went a step further because this was a war without the UN sanction and without congressional sanction here in the United States. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. Yugoslavia is officially recognized as NATO's first war and first offensive war as well. The events in Yugoslavia, it's more than one war, but Yugoslavia is officially recognized as this. Even U.S. Members of Congress didn't recognize that the first Gulf War after Saddam invaded Kuwait was tied to NATO. That's where U.S. attachés to Brussels would come in and inform them that this was NATO, a NATO operation. But I think it's very important not to lose sight that what the events in Iraq, what happened in the first Gulf War, is tied to Yugoslavia, and we can't separate any of these conflicts. We can't separate the events in Somalia, the events in Sudan, the events in Afghanistan, even the events in present-day Syria, and the events last year in Libya from this equation.
But to stick with Yugoslavia just for a second, there is a common understanding in the United States that this was a little bit different type of war, but a more humanitarian type of war. This was a war fought out of the goodness of our hearts as a sort of philanthropy to help the good people of the former Yugoslavia. You paint a different picture in your book.
I will paraphrase what one former U.S. Military commander said. He said that if we wanted to intervene in Yugoslavia, that's the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, before it broke up, but we knew if we would intervene, there would be guerrilla warfare. They would see it as an occupation. That's why everything was done piecemeal. This is why... The economic policies of the United States against Yugoslavia spell it out very clearly. Before the country broke up, the Reagan administration passed presidential directives to break up the country. This was a peaceful, humanitarian, we want to preserve Europe type operation. Yugoslavia stood in the way of NATO and European Union expansion. If it stayed there, like the Soviet Union, you wouldn't have seen such eastward expansion, and this is why it had to be eliminated as an alternative to the Euro-Atlantic project involving the European Union and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They already broke up the Soviet Union. Czechoslovakia broke up into two. They started replacing the governments there or helping new governments come into place. Which reformed the military. In fact, the entire military class of officers, which were very nationalistic, would be removed. They'd set new policies where politicians would take over. And this was they were afraid these military men could enact coup d'états against the new Western-supported politicians in Eastern Europe. So Yugoslavia cannot be seen as a humanitarian intervention at all. In fact, if it was a humanitarian intervention, the United States and its allies would have prevented the arms smuggling that was making the civil war in Bosnia worse and worse and worse. The Germans would have not even recognized the boundaries in the former Yugoslavia. They recognized Croatian independence before the boundaries were even declared. They had a lot to gain from the destruction of Yugoslavia. They turned those countries into colonies. They changed the laws where it's absurd. Anybody who hears this should find it absurd that the head of the Bank of Bosnia can't be a Bosnian citizen. In fact, all the administrations, not all of them, but almost all of them, set up in the former Yugoslavia were subordinate to the United States and the EU. The Bosnian Constitution, there was a high representative in Kosovo. There was, through the United Nations and through a separate body, there was a foreign administrator overseeing the government. So these countries were turned into colonies overnight, and their currencies either were the euro or they were controlled by the European Union and the United States and the International Monetary Fund and World Bank.
We are speaking with Mahdi Darius Nazemroya, the author of a wonderful new book, The Globalization of NATO. These wars look to the casual observer as sort of ad hoc and sporadic and reacting to crises, but you tell a story of a consistent motivation by NATO to expand its power and its reach and the size and the identity of Europe. And I wonder, where does the motivation behind NATO come from? Is it just as misrepresentative of the popular will in all its member states as their own governments, or is it sort of yet another step removed from actually representing people? Who is it that has these motivations that drive NATO's agenda?
I would say that the industrial and financial elites do ultimately. NATO is operating as an extension. It is an extension of U.S. Imperialist influence. That's the best way I could put it. It might sound outdated to some, might sound radical to others, but in reality, that is what NATO is. Because to join NATO, there has to be reforms in all the countries that join. Those reforms are not popular most of the time. They're political as well. There's no specific guidelines. It's set up by the North Atlantic Council in Brussels, the permanent body of ambassadors who represent each NATO state. But it's mostly the Anglo-American, the British and the U.S., that specifically the United States, that gets to say what these reforms should be. To an extent, the French and the Germans used to, as well as their allies. But it's predominantly the Anglo-American side within NATO. And no, it is not representative. If you think back to the Libyan War, the United States, which was the key combatant on the NATO side, the operation couldn't have taken place without the U.S.'s military assets, without the military might of the United States Armed Forces. If you look at that, you're going to see that the Obama administration hid behind NATO. It's very convenient to hide behind NATO. NATO is not accountable to it's not accountable to anybody. It's not a democratic body. It's a way to bypass democracy. In fact, you say, "Oh, well, NATO's the one bombing. It's not our country, but we're a part of NATO. We have to take part. This is a NATO operation. It's not a U.S. operation." It masked a U.S.-led operation, the war in Libya. The NATO war in Libya masked a U.S. operation because the United States, politicians in the United States know that their global image is down the drain since the Bush administration and Tony Blair's invasion of Iraq. Over a decade of perpetual war in across the world, three different countries, more than three, in fact, if you count the events in Syria and Lebanon as an extension of these wars. People don't have an appetite for this in the United States. They didn't want their politicians involved in another intervention with troops on the ground. So NATO was the best way to go forward. It's not representative at all. Even amongst NATO politicians at one point or another, such as in Greece and Iceland and France, there's been calls for pulling out, but yet they're all tied to NATO, and as they are tied to the United States, this is an undemocratic extension of the United States.
In fact, it's common, I think, to see atrocities in Afghanistan labeled as NATO rather than U.S. Army, because then Congress doesn't have oversight. And I I'm curious about Syria and Lebanon. You talk in the book about a drive by NATO to dominate the entire Mediterranean, and from there you get to the targeting of those nations. What is the motivation behind current interest in the West in terms of going into Syria or Iran? It's clearly not purely humanitarian.
No, it's not humanitarian by far. I'll just jump back to Lebanon. You know, when they were talking about humanitarianism, boatloads of people were dying in the Mediterranean trying to escape Libya. These were migrant workers from sub-Saharan Africa. They let them die in the ocean while they were sending SOS messages. It's not humanitarian whatsoever. I think this past few days, you can see that what the handiwork of NATO has done in Libya, in Benghazi, with the blowback there.
I should say for our listeners, we're recording this just following the death of the U.S. ambassador in Benghazi.
Murder. It's unfortunate, but this is part of the blowback. And it's also, I won't go too much into it, but this is directly or indirectly tied to U.S. actions there. Those are American allies on the ground that did that. Those are the people that were brought into Libya. I was in Libya actually during the war, so I know exactly what type of people were brought in, and I know for a fact that there were foreign NATO troops on the ground, you know, and Qatari troops, because I was there. I left with the gentlemen I left were left Tripoli with, on boat to Malta with Congressman Walter Fauntroy. We were on the same boat. Well, these gentlemen were either Italian special forces or Italian mercenaries, which the Italian government requested to be returned to Italy from Malta. So I know that they were on the ground there. But going back to your question, I'm sorry for digressing.
No, please do.
the United States, not just the United States, and the European Union, have had an expansion policy which works on two levels. One level is the political expansion, political and economic, which is through the EU. The other level is military and political, you know, and they're tied to each other. So all the countries that have joined the European Union have joined NATO. That's how it works. In the Mediterranean, it's the same thing. NATO has an equivalent to the Partnership for Peace program. The Partnership for Peace was created at the end of the Cold War. It was a way of keeping one foot in the door and one foot out of the door. It was meant to secure Europe for the United States after the fall of the Soviet Union and the dismantlement of the Warsaw Pact, which was the counter-alliance the Soviets made to oppose the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. After the Warsaw Pact was gone, the United States wanted to ensure that there would be no security alternative or military alliance that would rival the United States in Europe. What would it do? Well, what it did is create the Partnership for Peace, and the Partnership for Peace was also meant to help incubate these governments at the same time. It meant that they weren't fully a part of NATO, but they got one foot in the door while the U.S. changed their political structures, because this was very recent after the communists left, and they wanted to make sure the communists wouldn't come back into power. Imagine that Poland joins or Bulgaria joins NATO, and then a communist government comes into power. So the Partnership for Peace was meant to secure these countries while they were being restructured politically and economically by the United States and its allies in Western Europe. So this helped. Then NATO would expand. After NATO expands, these countries would expand to the European Union. Now, in the Mediterranean, around Europe, the non-European parts of the Mediterranean, as well as the Balkans, there's another program. It's called, from the European Union side, the NATO side, it's called the Mediterranean Dialogue. Now, this is the equivalent to the Partnership for Peace. All these countries are NATO partners. Every single country around the Mediterranean was a part of the Mediterranean dialogue, except for three: Libya, Lebanon, and Syria. The three countries the United States did not control in the Mediterranean, but these were not NATO partners. The rest were all NATO partners. That includes Israel. That includes Jordan, which Jordan doesn't border the Mediterranean, but it includes Jordan nonetheless. It includes Morocco. It includes Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt. These are all Mediterranean dialogue partners of the United States. The European Union, on a parallel track, has something called the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership. It was renamed by Sarkozy to the Union for the Mediterranean, or we can just simply call it the Mediterranean Union, which is it's an integration program of expanding the European Union in that area. So we can see NATO and EU expansion work together. Now, Lebanon and Syria both are not part of the NATO partnerships, and that has to do with because of the alliance system, and they're part of their Iranian allies. They're not in the same orbit as the other countries in the Mediterranean. But they were part of the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership, which opened up their economies. In fact, Syria, until it had its problems, starting last year, was a part of the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership or the Union for the Mediterranean. But it pulled out. It actually has suspended its cooperation because it realizes that this opens the door. But these countries are being expanded. I mean, targeted. Because of this expansion, they're at the frontier of the expanding Euro-Atlantic zone. This is why, in 2006, according to the Israelis themselves, to people tied to the Bush administration, Syria was the real target. And if you look back at Israeli strategic doctrine, and I'm talking about Richard Perl and associates. Their paper called A Clean Break. Who is the target? Syria. And it's not just about Israel. It's about expanding the realm for the United States. But Syria is a target because it's not in the orbit of the United States. Otherwise, if it was and it was killing protesters or acting in any violent manner, just like Saudi Arabia does or Bahrain or Jordan, you wouldn't hear anything from the United States. You have selective condemnation of human rights violations, and plus the United States is fueling the fighting there. Its allies are sending weapons in. There was a NATO spy mission. The Turkish jet there, without question, and I can categorically state this: the Turkish jet that was shot down over Syria was a spy plane. And I can explain exactly how that was a spy plane.
Because we're already over time, and this is such a wealth of knowledge, I am going to have to refer people to the book, which does more than we could possibly do in 10 radio shows. It turns upside down common understandings of our wars and affairs in the Middle East, exposes the hypocrisies, and tells a coherent story of what NATO has been up to and is up to. The book is called The Globalization of NATO. The author is Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. Mahdi, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christian Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.